seeing all of you here this morning. Some of you know the traditional Easter greeting where one person says, "He is risen," the other person says, "He is risen indeed." But many of you don't know where that came from. Obviously, it's based on Scripture, but people started using that as a greeting almost 2,000 years ago. It actually started and was passed down by the Eastern Orthodox churches. So you're talking about churches that are now Greece and Turkey and Russia and those kind of churches. And of course, you didn't just say the greeting. You also had to kiss each other three times on the cheek, one for each member of the Trinity. And so that was the practice. So we're going to practice that this morning. Now, you can do the kissing part if you want, but no tongues allowed. I'm joking, okay. Ready? He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
He is risen.
One more time. He is risen.
He is risen.
All right. As Jay already mentioned, you have these cards in your bulletin. If you don't have one of these, there's more in the lobby. And I'm excited about this. Have you ever wished that you knew how to pray better? Have you ever wished that you knew that you were praying for the right things? Well, this prayer covenant card is being used by millions of people around the world, and like Jay said, there's 25 churches in Hamilton handing them out this morning, and they're using it to help them pray better, pray more consistently, and pray about the right things. And so next Sunday, we, along with many of the other churches in Hamilton, are going to be starting a series of messages teaching about what's on this card. And so our goal is that over the next 6 weeks that we will see God move powerfully in this community, in our churches, and especially in each one of our lives, in our families. Because we want to see some answered prayers. I mean, don't know about you. Anybody want to see answered prayers? Yeah, that's what I want, okay? And so that's going to start next week. How many of you have filled out a March Madness bracket? Anybody here? Okay, some of you are liars. Okay. My wife, Kathy, has one at her work every year, and so if you win, it's like $100. And so I join in with her every year, and I fill out my bracket, and I have high hopes every year, and then I lose every year. Well, this year I did something different because I subscribed to the online version of the Wall Street Journal, and for their online subscribers, they had this bracket app this year. And basically how it works is you put in some priorities like defense, offense, tournament experience, things like that. But then using all the stats from all the teams that's built into this app, they pick your teams for you based on all the stats. And I saw that and I said, whoa, you know, I've got an advantage that nobody else has. This is my year. I am guaranteed to win this year. And I was so excited. And so I got my bracket. And let me just say that I am once again hopeless. At least when it comes to the basketball tournament. I'm already out of it again. Anybody heard of Warren Buffett? Like the third richest man in the world with 60-some billion dollars. Maybe you heard that 2 years ago, Warren Buffett actually offered a $1 billion prize to anybody who filled out and got all of the bracket, March Madness bracket, correct. You're wondering, how could he risk $1 billion on that? You know, what if somebody got really lucky? Well, Buffett is no buffoon. And he knows the incredibly high odds of that ever happening. In fact, mathematicians can't even agree on how to calculate the odds, but some mathematicians have put the odds at 1 in 9 million trillion of getting it all right. So after Buffett offered that prize, 11 million people actually filled out the bracket and tried to win the $1 billion. All of them were out within 31 hours of the beginning of the tournament. Well, this year, Buffett isn't offering a $1 billion prize, but he is offering $1 million a year for life to any of his employees who can pick all the winners correctly up to the Sweet 16. So you don't even have to get the whole tournament right, just the first two rounds up to the Sweet 16. And there are 360,000 employees of his company, so they all had high hopes this year. Of course, there is no record of anybody ever even picking all the picks right up to the Sweet 16. So again, Buffett is pretty safe. But he does offer a consolation prize. The consolation prize is $100,000. That's not too bad. That's for whoever gets the most right. Have you ever hoped for something that had really long, long odds? It's like the guy who went in for an interview for a job driving a delivery truck, and he said, they asked him, you know, why do you want this job? He said, well, it's because my dad drove a delivery truck, and you know, I hope to make $1 million just like my dad. They said, your dad made $1 million driving a delivery truck? No, but he always hoped to. Sometimes our hopes are not based on much. And this morning I want to talk about two types of hope. Hope for something and hope in someone. First, there's the kind of hope where you're hoping for something. When you're hoping for something, you're hoping that a particular circumstance or a situation will work out just right the way you want it to. You know, I hope I get that job. I hope I get that house. I hope I get that girl. Or even better, I hope I get that girl who has a nice house and a good job. Now, of course, sometimes the thing we're hoping for is for something not to happen or to avoid something. And of course, the granddaddy of all those hopes is the hope to avoid death. And so we say things like, I hope it's not cancer. I hope that she makes it. I hope the test comes back okay. But whenever we hope for something, it's always very temporary because circumstances in our lives are always temporary. For example, even if our hope for death, or to avoid death, is fulfilled today or this week or even this year, we all know that one day, even that hope will disappoint us. If it's not cancer this year, you know, it'll be something else eventually. The mortality rate right now is running right about 100%. And so the simple truth is that one day, everything that you hope for will eventually disappoint you. Everything that we hope for, every circumstance, every situation that we're hoping for is going to wear out or fall apart, melt down, give out, or go away. And when that happens, the question then is about deeper hope, about your foundation hope or your fallback hope when all your other hopes are disappointed. And when you've lost that something that you're hoping for, then the ultimate question is, have you met the someone that you can put your hope in? And that's really the whole message of the Bible right there. It all points to one man, the Son of God, not because of what he's able to give us, this thing or that thing or whatever thing is we're hoping for, because all those things and circumstances are eventually going to disappoint us. No, the Bible points to the Son of God as the one person that we put our hope in so that our hope will never end. I'm going to tell a story this morning from the Old Testament. Don't worry, we'll get back to the Easter story. But first, there's a story from early on in the history of Israel. Moses led them to the Promised Land, and then Joshua helped them to get settled there. But they don't yet have a king. This is before David and Solomon and the other kings. And during this time, they're struggling to survive as a nation, because they keep turning away from God and they keep ignoring him. And so God says, basically, you know, if you're going to keep ignoring me, then don't expect me to come bail you out when you get in trouble. And of course, they got in trouble very quickly. The Philistines invade, and Israel is forced to go to battle with Philistines to defend their homes, and they lost the battle. And after the battle, the leaders get together and they're asking, what happened? Where was God? We were counting on him. Why didn't he give us what we hoped for? Have you ever had a time in your life when you were pretty much ignoring God until something bad happened? Somebody gets sick or has an accident or loses a job or the relationship ends or one of your kids makes a bad choice. And then you throw up a quick prayer to God and say, you know, God, rescue me from this situation. God, I need your help right now. But God doesn't help. He doesn't rescue you. Has that ever happened to you? And of course, then you're ticked off and you say, God, where were you? I was counting on you to help me. I thought you were on my side. You know, how could you let this happen? Even though, of course, you were pretty much ignoring him. Well, that's where Israel is in this story. They're in big trouble. They lost the big battle. But then somebody gets a bright idea. They say, let's go back into battle with the Philistines tomorrow, but this time we'll use our secret weapon. This time we'll bring the Ark of the Covenant into battle with us. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was a box where they kept the stone tablets that had the Ten Commandments on them. And if you ever saw the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, that was an idea of what it looked like. You can see it behind me. But to the people of Israel, the Ark wasn't just a box. The Ark was like the presence of God. The way they thought about it, it was like God in a box. In fact, it almost became like an idol to them. They thought that God actually lived in that box, and they were sure if they brought the Ark of the Covenant into battle with them, then God would never let the enemy capture the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, that would be like capturing God, and God certainly isn't going to let that happen. And so they thought, if we take the Ark into battle, God will have to give us what we're hoping for. We'll win for sure. Now, of course, the truth about God is that God doesn't live in a box, and God can't be manipulated into giving us what we hope for. But that's what the Israelites are trying to do, and so they go into battle the second time, this time carrying the Ark with them, and it is a disaster. They actually lose 7 times more soldiers on this second day than they did the first time around, and worst of all, the Ark of the Covenant is captured. And this is like unthinkable. This is like losing the presence of God from their nation. They are devastated. This is such a huge deal that when the ruling priest of Israel named Eli hears about it, he falls down, breaks his neck, and dies. When his pregnant daughter-in-law hears about it, she immediately goes into labor, dies in childbirth, but before she dies, she says she wants her son named Ichabod, which means the glory has departed. The glory is gone. She's saying, the Ark is gone, the glory is gone from Israel, God is no longer with us. You ever felt like that? Maybe you once felt close to God. Maybe you once had some faith. But it's not the same anymore. The glory is gone. God doesn't seem to be blessing me anymore. He's not with me. I don't feel Him working in my life anymore, and we lose hope. But it's when the people of Israel have lost everything that they're hoping for, it's then that God goes to work. And the Philistines carried the Ark of the Covenant to one of their capital cities named Ashdod, where the temple of their Philistine god is. They call him Dagon. And the priests of Dagon take the Ark inside the temple, and they place it next to the statue of Dagon. Put a picture of here. Up here. And then all the Philistines cheer because they think that Dagon has won over this other god. You know, it's clear to them that Dagon is the more powerful god, and so they have a big feast, and they're celebrating their victory, and everybody's telling the battle stories, and everybody goes home for the night. And then something happened during the night at the temple. The priests come back in the morning and on the second day, and the Bible says, when the people of Ashdod came in early the next day, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. Well, the priests are a little bit shocked because it looks sort of like Dagon has bowed down to worship the real God. It looks sort of like God of Israel is really the powerful one, really the Lord of Lords. And in any case, Dagon's priests realize, well, it doesn't look good to have our God bowing down to theirs. And so they quickly dust off Dagon and they prop him back up. And all day long on the second day, the Philistines come into the temple and they're celebrating their victory. They're offering sacrifices to their great god, Dagon. And then it's night again and the priests turn out the lights and go home. And again, something happens during the night. The next morning, on the third day, the priests come in and they find that once more their god Dagon has fallen on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. But this time, not only that, but his head and his hands are cut off. And so all that's left is a stump. By the way, wouldn't you love to know how Dagon lost his head. The Bible doesn't give us any details. I guess the person who wrote this didn't have a head for details. I know, that was really bad, wasn't it? You know, I should have quit while I was ahead. But of course, the priests are horrified that their god is now a stump. And then to make it worse, on that third day, a plague starts to sweep over the city. Some experts think that it was the bubonic plague. And the whole city falls into panic, and the people shout, "Get that ark out of our city now, today, or we're all going to die." And so they send the ark away, and it eventually makes its way back to Israel. And though we don't know all the details of this story, we do know that this is a three-day story. The first day was a very dark day. The battle is lost. The ark is captured. It looks like the God of Israel is defeated. The glory is gone. It looks like the enemy has won. That's the first day. And some days are like that, aren't they? You know, maybe you feel like that's where you are right now. Maybe you feel like a part of your life just feels sort of dark and defeated. Your marriage feels pretty dark. Maybe or maybe you feel like you're never going to get married. Your kids are having one setback after another. You're feeling defeated about that. Or your finances are difficult and they're getting worse, and you don't know how you're going to dig your way out of the hole. Or the doctor's office called and you need to go in for another test. Sometimes it just feels like one thing after another, doesn't it? Darkness and defeat. And that leads to the second day. And the second day is a day of doubt and confusion. It's full of questions. What is God doing? Is he doing anything? Is he really at work behind the scenes? Is he really going to work it all out? You know, I'm trying to trust him. I'm trying to follow him, but I don't see anything happening. The second day is a day of doubt and confusion. And some days are like that, aren't they? Full of doubt and confusion. Maybe that's where you feel like you're at right now. You have doubt and confusion about your relationship with God. Or maybe you have doubt about what he wants you to do. Doubt about his plans for you. Is he going to provide for you? What is he doing in your life? Is he doing anything? And you're not sure that it's all going to work out. But if that's where you're at, then hold on, because this isn't a two-day story. The story's not over yet. This is a three-day story. And on the third day, the story takes a radical turn. The idol is overturned. The enemy is sent into panic and defeat. The time of captivity is over. God is going to come home to his people because the third day is God's day. The third day is the day of hope. And you see this pattern over and over again in the Bible. You know, often the people in the Bible are told that God is going to answer their prayers. God is going to do what they ask, but first, they have to wait. Deliverance is coming. God is at work behind the scenes. He's going to come through and make it all work out. But the waiting period in so many of the stories is 3 days. When a hero named Joseph was in prison and a fellow prisoner has a dream from God, Joseph interpreted it and he said, "Hey, God is going to get you out of this prison. God is going to set you free. He's going to restore your job, restore your life, but you're going to have to wait 3 days. When Israel was trapped in slavery and they're trying to get free, Moses asked Pharaoh, "Let us go 3 days into the wilderness." Later on, Israel is threatened with annihilation. A teenage girl named Esther says that she's going to fast for 3 days and then go to the king to try and get their deliverance. When Moses leads the people to Mount Sinai, God tells the people, "Get the people ready, because in 3 days I'm going to come, I'm going to appear to them." When Jonah is swallowed by a big fish, anybody want to take a guess how many days he's in the fish? 3 days before he's released. When the people of Israel were afraid to go into the promised land, God said to them, "Don't be afraid. Don't be worried, don't be discouraged, because 3 days from now, I'm going to come out and you're going to cross the Jordan and take possession of the land I've given you." It's no accident that all these stories have a three-day waiting period till God brought deliverance, till God showed up in power, because God was preparing us for the ultimate third day, the ultimate day of deliverance. And we see the same story over and over again. Right now,
the first day, things are messed up. And our hearts are discouraged and hope is being crushed. But a better day is coming. A third day is coming. In the book of Hosea, the prophet says it like this. Come, let us return to the Lord. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will restore us so that we may live in his presence. And so the reason that we're all here this morning is because of the third day. It's that one day that God came to rescue his people. The Bible says in John 1:14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And by the way, the word for dwelling there is the same word that they used for tabernacle. What did they keep in the tabernacle? The Ark of the Covenant. The symbol of God's presence with them. And then John says, we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son. You see, when the Israelites lost the ark, they said, the glory has departed. It's gone. But now it's telling us that the glory of God is back with us, and now it's here to stay. But again, the glory took 3 days to show itself. It took Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There's a pastor named Tony Campolo who tells a great story called Sunday's a Coming. And he starts by telling how in 1948, Harry Truman ran for re-election as the 33rd president of the United States, and all the public opinion polls predicted that his opponent, Dewey, would win in a landslide. And the Chicago Tribune had already published their headline that Dewey defeats Truman. Life magazine had already published an issue proclaiming Dewey's victory. Dewey was already writing his victory speech, and Truman's supporters felt dark and defeated. But despite what looked like certain defeat, despite all the commentators and all the polls and all the newspapers that said he didn't have a chance, Harry Truman turned sure defeat into a great victory. And that's what happened 2,000 years ago. The same thing. It started on a dark, dismal Friday. Jesus was in the upper room with 11 disciples because Judas had already left to betray him, the first step in a downward spiral that led to horrible death. And then Jesus left the upper room. He took his disciples to a lonely garden, and he told them, my soul is overwhelmed to the point of despair. He was so overcome with desperation that he fell on his face on the ground, praying to his Father with such intensity that his sweat was like drops of blood. He knew that soon he would carry the weight of the world's sin on his own shoulders. And he knew that sin would separate him from his Father for the first time ever. And then Judas comes and gives Jesus that kiss of betrayal, and the soldiers come and they bind him and take him away. The disciples flee into the night. It looked like everything was lost. It looked like the enemy of the world had won the day. But it was only Friday, and Sunday's coming. And then came the mockings and the beatings. The temple guards blindfolded Jesus, and they took turns beating him with their fists. And as they hit him, they said, well, Jesus, if you're the prophet, like everybody says, tell us who's hitting you. But it was only Friday, and Sunday is coming. And next, they tied him to a Roman whipping post, and they gave him 39 lashes with a lead-tipped whip. And they could only give him 39 because 40 was thought to kill a man. And Jesus hangs there with blood pouring from his body in unbelievable pain. And those Roman and the Jewish leaders think that they won. They think that Jesus is done. He's over. He's history. He's defeated. But that was Friday, and Sundays are coming. The crowd is shouting for his death. The crowd that less than a week ago, when Jesus rode into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, they were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! Now, the crowd has changed. Now when Pontius Pilate asks him, what shall I do with the one that they call King of the Jews? They shout, crucify him, crucify him. And it looks like it's the end. It looks like nobody's on his side anymore. He's defeated. But that was Friday, and Sundays are coming.
And they forced Jesus to carry his cross through the streets of Jerusalem, up and down those winding dirt roads. He's stumbling. He's half dead already. The streets are lined with thousands of people ignoring or mocking or jeering. It looks like the end. It looks like certain defeat. But that was Friday, and Sunday is coming. And then Jesus is stripped naked, and they nail him to the cross, spikes through his wrists and feet, every breath in agony. As hundreds around him are laughing at him and mocking and jeering and insulting him, Jesus hangs suspended between heaven and earth, blood pouring from his wounds. He cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then he breathes his last breath and says, it is finished. Hangs his head and dies. And the sky turns black. There's a terrifying earthquake. It looks like Jesus is done for. He's defeated. He's gone forever. The Pharisees and the religious leaders are celebrating. There's parties thrown throughout the city celebrating the death of Jesus. Satan and his demons are throwing another party because their enemy is dead. But it was only Friday, and Sunday's a-coming. And when it looked like the deepest darkness had overcome, when it looked like the enemy had won, when it looked like the end of all hope, the truth is, the darkness was already starting to lift. The victory was already on its way. Jesus was about to burst forth from the grave in power and great glory because Sunday was coming. Friday was a dark day. It looked like a terrible defeat. The second day, Saturday, was a day of doubt and confusion. But this isn't a one-day story. It's not a two-day story. The story of Jesus is a three-day story. And on the third day, the disciples discovered that there was greater news than anything that they had hoped for. Because they discovered not just something to hope for, but someone to put their hope in. Someone that even death could not defeat. And what on Friday looked to be a terrible defeat turned out to be the greatest victory of all time. And you see, the third day is God's day. The third day is the day when prisoners of Pharaoh get set free. The third day is the day when the people come to the mountain and the mountain starts to shake. The third day is the day when rivers are parted and people go into the promised land. The third day is the day when teenage girls like Esther stand up to powerful kings. The third day is the day when prophets like Jonah are dropped off at the beach by a giant fish. The third day is the day when idols like Dagon come tumbling down and God starts coming home to his people. And the third day is the day when stones are rolled away, the resurrection comes, and life happens to you and I. And the person that we hope in defeats death forever. So the only other question about Easter is this. What will you and I do with it? Are we going to keep on for the rest of our lives hoping for things which will ultimately disappoint us? I don't know what you're hoping for this morning, but the real question is, what are you putting your ultimate hope in? What do you build your life's foundation on? A lot of people are putting their hope in something or some circumstance. Maybe it's money, maybe it's success, maybe it's security or power, maybe it's romance or affection. All those things will eventually let you down. Some of you have already experienced that. In a crowd like this, there's all kinds of problems represented. There are people here with marriage problems. Maybe you're right now considering divorce or separation. Some of you have recently buried a loved one, and you still have the grief in you. Others are having problems with kids. Others of you would like to get married, and you're lonely, but it's not happening. There are people here who are going through financial and job situations and problems. Some of you are here are facing serious health problems, and maybe you're waiting for a test from the doctor. You don't know how it's going to turn out. There's people here who are dealing with stress and guilt and grief, and maybe it feels like your life just hasn't turned out the way you had hoped. But the good news of Easter is that if God is more powerful than death, then he is more powerful than any situation that you're facing. No matter what your problem is, it is not beyond God's power. No circumstances out of his control. He can cause a resurrection in your life as well. You can put your hope in the one place on earth where it can never be disappointed. No circumstance, no disappointment, no accident, no guilt or stress or regret or not even death itself. You can put your hope in the Son of God who overcame death, who died for our sins, and then was raised from the dead on the third day. We're going to close now, so I'd like the worship band to come up. As they come up, guess what? It's not Friday anymore. Today is Sunday. And that means that you and I can join in the celebration. We can celebrate with Jesus right now the victory that he won over death. And we never have to fear death again. If you haven't joined into the party yet, if you haven't joined God's family, if you haven't become a follower of Jesus, if you haven't made him the director of your life, then you can become a part of that right now. You can join the party and celebrate along with us. Let's stand for prayer and celebrate the resurrection day.
Death by night.